طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This week, we continue our coverage of Palestinian journalist, author, and activist Ali Abu Nima, speaking at the New York Forum a couple of weeks ago. Last week on This Week in Palestine, we featured his presentation, which focused on the history of Israeli occupation of Palestine and its continuing expanding colonization of Palestinian land. You can hear part one by going to our archive at truthandjusticeradio.org. That's all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org. And clicking on This Week in Palestine Archive. So here is part two of Ali Abu Nima continuing his analysis of the occupation and colonization of Palestine and speaking about his work as a journalist and book author. It begins with a question from the moderator.
So this question is precisely about this. How do we deal with AIPAC and the Israel lobby? How do we get them out of foreign diplomacy? What do we do about U.S. politics supporting Israel?
Well, you know, I think we do what we've been doing, which is, you know, you have to push for the grassroots in every area that we're working. We have to push, you know, I don't... I think I go through waves of disillusionment and encouragement about the possibilities in electoral politics in the United States. And I think the recent experience with the Bernie Sanders campaign, I was very skeptical about it, but I was willing to say, okay, let's see what happens. You know, it's not that I'm a huge fan of Bernie Sanders. It's that I recognize that a lot of people at the grassroots are putting energy into this and believe in it and are doing it for the right reasons. And so let's put our hope and our faith in them, not in, you know, any particular candidate and politician. But just seeing how Bernie Sanders really just decided to throw in the towel at the very moment when, the cruelty and the failures of this system became so apparent in the context of the pandemic, and to say, you know, everyone has to vote for Joe Biden is really disillusioning. It's really hard for, I think, to take seriously any electoral strategy. But at the same time, we do see that there is still a lot of energy in local races. I mean, Jamal Bowman in New York, who, just won an upset against Elliot Engel, you know, a huge dinosaur of the Democratic Party establishment and a huge supporter of Israel, massive supporter of Israel. So, you know, it didn't matter how much support Elliot Engel got from the Israel lobby, from the Democratic Party establishment, he could still be thrown out. So I think the lesson there, sort of the key message I take from all of that, is that we have to be very careful about disempowering ourselves with a narrative that says, you know, the Israel lobby is so strong it can't be defeated. AIPAC is so powerful and influential, there's nothing that can be done. And I don't know that that's what the questioner is getting at, but I hear that a lot when I go out and speak to people. You know, it's sort of this constant refrain. It's very disempowering. yesterday on the Electronic Intifada, we published a report, we published a story. We obtained the minutes of the Jewish Federation in Chicago, which is, of course, one of the big Israel lobby groups in Chicago and nationally plays a big role. And they had done a report, a confidential report on Chicago solidarity groups, Palestine solidarity groups. And it was very uplifting for us to get hold of that report and read it, because they said we had scored major successes in Chicago. They called the situation from their perspective depressing, upsetting. Those are the words they used in the report. They were talking about how a young generation of Arab American and Muslim American activists were scoring victories on campuses. And they, you know, for them, this was all doom and gloom. But for us, it's a very good news story. The other thing they were very upset about was how the Palestine Solidarity Movement was forging alliances, intersectional alliances, alliances across issues and communities on immigrant rights, on Black Lives Matter, on, you know, a whole range of issues that were really pushing the question of Palestinian rights and U.S. support for Israel into the mainstream in a way that they have just been unable to stop the momentum. So I think that's a good news story. I mean, it's very hard to find good news these days, but, you know, there is good news there. And I think we just have to keep pushing at the grassroots, keep educating people, keep demanding more. I mean, this is the one thing, one frustration I've had with a lot of politics on the left is people, a lot of it has been, this was particularly true in the Obama era, people aren't willing to ask for enough. They're just so grateful that Obama, you know, they were so grateful that Obama was elected. Like, oh, we can't criticize him because he's under attack from the right. Well, you don't get anything if you don't ask. So we have to have very strong, clear demands and not ask for half a loaf, ask for 100% of the loaf. And when you get it, ask for more. That's the only way you move the goalposts. It's the only way you move the political discourse. If you only play politics on the territory that is already acceptable, you don't move anything. You only move things by asking for what is not deemed acceptable now. That's the only way you shift the discourse. And I think that's a key lesson we have to learn. We have to keep pushing.
Yes, we need to remain optimists and not get given to this pessimism that says nothing can be done. I agree with you. I want to maybe get a little bit more on the basic concept, especially for those who are anti-Zionist in the U.S. This is not an easy thing to do. If you say that you're anti-Zionist, if you participate in organizing against the Israeli occupation, you can be attacked. You can be accused of being anti-Semitic. You can be accused of supporting terrorism, of being anti-American, anything. You can lose your job. Many things can happen. Can you explain for us, what is Zionism? What does it mean to be against Zionism? What is the relationship between Zionism and racism? And why is it important to take these kinds of risks, if we can?
Yeah, that's such a good question, because, okay, Zionism in the simplest way is the belief that Jews from anywhere in the world have the right to settle in Palestine and create a Jewish majority state, and that that right is superior to the rights of the indigenous population of Palestine. And, you know, if you ask Zionists what Zionism is, they'll give you all these sorts of mystical and romantic things. Oh, it's the liberation movement of the Jewish people. And we have this, you know, spiritual connection to the land and all this sort of thing. That's not where you have to look for, you don't look at like, go to Hillel on a, you know, an Ivy League campus to understand Zionism. That's not where you're going to find an accurate description of Zionism. Where you're going to find an accurate description of Zionism is in Palestine on the ground. Because what does it mean to have a Jewish majority state in Palestine. Well, in 1948, it meant the ethnic cleansing of most of the Palestinian population, because most of the population in the country was not Jewish. So you couldn't have a Jewish majority state unless you forced them out. And that's what happened in 1948. Now, you can't maintain a Jewish majority state there without continuing the denial of Palestinian rights, which means not allowing Palestinian refugees to return. So Zionists don't want Palestinian refugees to come back to the land from which they were expelled, or their parents were expelled, or their grandparents were expelled, solely and exclusively because they're not Jews. So that's the connection to racism. Zionism says that you Palestinians, you don't have the right to live in your own country, the country where you were born, or your parents were born, or your grandparents were born, because you're the wrong religion. You're from the wrong ethno-religious group. And this isn't applied to other refugee populations. I mean, nobody says, you know, everybody accepts, you know, the horrifying war in Syria. When it's over, when it's safe for people to return to Syria, they should be allowed to return to Syria. That's, everyone understands that's their right. That's the right for refugees in every country in the world to return when it's safe to do so. But for Palestinians, it's sort of this mainstream view that, well, of course they can't return because they're not Jews. To which other refugee group is that racist logic applied, that you can't go back to the land in which you were born just because you're from the wrong ethnic group? So Zionism is inherently racist. And if you are a Zionist, you have to support this racism. You can't support a Jewish state without supporting racism against Palestinians, because as Zionists rightly point out, if Palestinians are given equal rights, then Israel will no longer have a Jewish majority. Zionists fear that, and they're right to point that out. Already today, in historic Palestine, Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza Strip together, Palestinians are at least 50% of the population and probably 52-53%. So there's already a Palestinian majority. When you add back the Palestinian refugees, Palestinians outnumber Israeli Jews 2-1. That's a fact of life. Nobody, you know, nobody can change those numbers. That's the reality. The only thing that can be decided by people is whether Palestinians will have rights or not. And Zionists say, no, Palestinians should not have rights, because if they have rights, we will no longer be in control of everything. And that's very banal racism. It's the same racism that led whites in apartheid South Africa to oppose the end of apartheid, because they said, well, whites are a minority. If we give black people political power and the vote, they'll outnumber us. And we don't want that, because we want to remain in control. The same logic underlay support for Jim Crow in the United States and segregation. We can't give black people the vote, because if they do, they'll vote for things we don't like. They'll take away our power. So Zionism is inherently racist, because that racism, by the way, is baked into Israel's laws and constitution. People often say that Israel doesn't have a constitution. It doesn't have a big C constitution. It doesn't have one document called the constitution, but does have a constitution. All countries do. It's just a collection of laws. And the most recent constitutional law that Israel passed, the so-called nation state law, which it passed in, I think it was 2018, enshrines that Jews have superior rights to Palestinians. And there are 65 other laws that give Jews superior rights to Palestinians. And what Palestinians are saying is that we have to have equal rights. So, you know, there is no Palestinian party today, not Hamas, not any party, that is saying we want to expel 5 million Israeli Jews. What Palestinians are saying in one form or another is we want equal rights. And You have to look at other settler colonial situations for possible models. I think the most hopeful is South Africa, where a one person, one vote system was instituted. Black people were given a one vote, one person. Black people were given, they won political power through their struggle, I should say. But it didn't go far enough because there was no economic democracy. There was no economic liberation for most Black people in South Africa. But certainly, you know, we have to look at those kinds of models for a future, not segregation, not separation, perpetuating division along racial and ethnic lines. So just to complete the thought, there is nothing anti-Semitic about anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism is opposition to a racist political ideology and practice. Anti-Semitism is hatred of Jews for being Jews. And that's something everyone should reject and should fight against. And you'll find me and other Palestinians in the first ranks of fighting against anti-Semitism. But there are two groups of people who want us to believe that anti-Zionism equals anti-Semitism. The first group is Zionists and Israel, who say that all criticism of Israel is actually anti-Semitic. All criticism of Israel means you hate Jewish people. That's obviously false and a propaganda, but it's a very dangerous smear. The other group that wants us to believe that Zionism and Judaism are the same is anti-Semites. And we have to insist on refusing that equation. But it's an equation Israel wants to make, and it's an equation that Jew haters want to make. Jew haters will always, you know, I'll see this on Twitter sometimes where, you know, I'll say something about Israel and someone will respond to me, well, that's the way Jews are. I reject that. That's not the way Jews are. That's the way Israel as a settler colonial state is. And my allies in fighting the racism of Zionism, of course, include many, many Jews and many Jewish organizations. And those Jewish organizations and individuals have been smeared by Israel and have been attacked by Israel and have been called anti-Semites by Israel. So it's an attempt to intimidate us politically. We have to be very clear in our thinking. I am as opposed to anti-Semitism, which is bigotry against Jewish people, as I am to Zionism. And they go hand in hand. And I think we just stand our ground, be principled, and don't allow ourselves to be intimidated by this discourse. And, you know, as we said, with the change in the discourse, the grassroots discourse, which is becoming more open, more supportive of Palestinian rights, I think that's a sign that the effort to intimidate people through false accusations of anti-Semitism and trying to equate criticism of Israel's policies with anti-Semitism, that strategy is failing.
Thank you very much. I want to bring our conversation to the current moment for a bit. You know, recently there's been many killings of Palestinians by the Israeli state. It's gotten some media attention. Of course, this is nothing new. But we're also in a moment of unprecedented uprisings against police brutality, the resurgence of the Black Lives Movement, a fight against the prison and police institutions for abolition. And we know that there's an exchange in terms of tactics, materials, supplies for these two settler states who rely so much on prisons and police and military for maintaining their control over people and territory. So what can we do to increase and strengthen solidarity, and how should we approach this relationship?
Yeah, that's such an important issue because that relationship is very deep and it was uncontested for a long time. And when I wrote The Battle for Justice in Palestine, which came out in 2014, I think the chapter I have in there on what I called shared values between Israel and the United States was really the first sort of book-length look at the close relationship between U.S. police and Israeli forces. And I wrote that in the context of The New Jim Crow, the work by Michelle Alexander on mass incarceration in the United States, and looking at not just the ideological similarities between Zionism and Israeli rule over Palestinians on the one hand, and the New Jim Crow, the perpetuation of the white supremacist state and mass incarceration of Black people in the U.S. on the other, but also the material links. And one of the material links is this massive, let's call it an industry, of Israel lobby groups taking senior U.S. law enforcement officials, and this includes federal, state, and local officials. It includes Department of Homeland Security, includes pretty much every big city police force, taking them on junkets to Israel and marketing Israel as a model for U.S. policing. You know, that, and again, the marketing, this really accelerated. It's been going on since the early 80s at least, but it really accelerated after 9/11, where Israel rebranded itself as the expert on homeland security. We live in a tough neighborhood. We're surrounded by terrorists. We know how to fight it. You Americans are not used to this. You may have fought foreign wars, but you're not used to terrorism on your streets. We tough, down-to-earth Israelis are. And that was the marketing line. And so it was literally marketing, because Israel was selling billions of dollars, still is, of so-called homeland security technology to U.S. law enforcement agencies and the federal government. And some of it was just rebranded racism. So one example I talk about in the book was this Israeli company founded by the former head of security at Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, which claimed that, you know, they had this really sophisticated profiling technique. Wasn't racist. It's not ethnic profiling. But, you know, we can tell by the way people are walking or the way they're looking if they're a terrorist. So we're going to deploy this in your airports. And in fact, they deployed it in Boston Airport and other airports around the country. And the whistleblowers, the TSA agents that came forward, and they were whistleblowers. There was a big story in the New York Times, among others, with TSA whistleblowers coming over and saying, it was just racism. We were just told to, like, if we saw a Black person who looked like they were dressed in clothes that were too expensive, to stop them. Hispanic or Latino people, I'm using the terms they were using, Latino people, that we would stop them, that we were told to look for drugs, even though that's not the job of the TSA. And then it was just racial profiling. But if you can call it sophisticated Israeli technology, then, you know, people think, oh, that's great. So this has been going on for decades. It intensified after 9/11. And it was a way for Israel lobby groups not just to sort of strengthen this relationship at the police level with Israel, but also it was about building elite support. But it's also a vulnerability for the Israel lobby, because now that there's this massive backlash against racist policing and calls to defund the police, we see the Israel lobby on the defensive, and groups that are involved in this, like the Anti-Defamation League, trying to justify why they're doing these police exchanges. And we've seen campaigns like, there's a campaign called Deadly Exchange, which aims to end these police exchanges. And there have been successes. The city of Durham, North Carolina, for example, voted to ban police exchanges with foreign countries. But the impetus was because they were going over to Israel. So that's one of the, I think by talking about that, by exposing it, by letting people know the facts, it's one of the ways we can show the ideological and material connections between the United States and Israel as racist, settler colonial societies and systems.
We also have, in this current moment, the pandemic, and we've seen how this has played out in very uneven ways across the world, where the states with the most economic wealth, the capitalist and imperialist states, have actually suffered the most highest rates of death and sickness. We can see how they've been prioritizing economic profit in a time of global pandemic. We've seen states that are more socialist states, that are more focused on humanity, actually providing international solidarity. China has given international material solidarity, Cuba, others. Can you talk about how the pandemic has played out in this situation in Palestine? How has Israel responded to it? How have Palestinians responded? What's the unevenness there? And what kind of solidarity, if there has been any, what kind of solidarity have you seen?
Yeah, that's another really good question. And in Palestine, it's really shown the vulnerability of Palestinians to, you know, that they really have no control over their lives living under this Israeli military dictatorship. In the West Bank, there is unfortunately an alarming increase in cases. Israel has a very high rate. They had it under some control and then they opened up, and now it's really out of control again and they're shutting down again. For Palestinians in the West Bank, really the vulnerability was the exposure to Israel, because under Israeli occupation, we talked about Area C, Palestinians can't build factories in Area C. They can't develop their own economy under Israeli occupation. So they're very dependent on doing menial labor and low-paid work in Israel. So a lot of Palestinian laborers have to go to Israel. They are forced to live in, if their employers at all give them housing, in very cramped, very unsanitary conditions. And this is, by the way, very similar to what we see for a lot of the migrant workers that we depend on for our food supply in this country. So, you know, if you think about what migrant workers who are picking the fruits and vegetables that we eat and we take for granted, in this country, they're facing many of the same conditions. And that's what, you know, there have been human rights groups that have said that, you know, many of the first cases or the first clusters could be linked to Palestinian laborers who came back from Israel and then, you know, infected their families. So that vulnerability is very apparent. We've seen Israel obstructing Palestinian healthcare in many, many ways, even to the point of demolishing COVID-19 clinics and testing centers in the West Bank. We've also seen Israel taking advantage of the pandemic to market its cyber warfare companies under the guise of contact tracing. So, you know, there's this really nefarious Israeli company called NSO Group that is being sued by Amnesty International for what they do is NSO Group has this technology called Pegasus, where they can infect your phone with a malware that allows them to get full access to it. And they sell this to governments. So some of the most repressive governments in the world, including the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia and others, have bought this Israeli technology to use it to spy on journalists, on human rights activists, and so on. And the same company, NSO Group, is marketing itself to countries around the world and saying, oh, well, we can give you a mobile phone app for contact tracing or for people to download. Who would want that? Oh, my God. You know, this Israeli company that is spying on people through their phones and you're going to download their app. But we've seen reports in the Israeli press that Israeli forces, that as a condition for Palestinian laborers to be given permits to go into Israel and work, they have to download an app on their phone, an app that has access to their photos, their microphone, to their messages, and so on. I haven't seen the reports identify who made the app. I suspect it's very likely that it's NSO Group or a similar company. But that's an example of Israel using Palestinians as guinea pigs for testing and developing surveillance technologies that can then be deployed more widely. So Israel continued to exploit the pandemic to, in a sense, tighten its control over Palestinian life. And in the meantime, Palestinians remain extremely vulnerable, dependent on what Israel allows them to do or allows them to have in terms of ability to combat the pandemic.
I have a question about study and education, political education, to better understand what's going on. You have mentioned, and I agree, we need to go back. We need to go further back. We can't fully understand the correlation of forces that's convening on this moment to continue the oppression of Palestine without studying the, quite honestly, rather short history of Israel. It's only been 70 or so years in existence. And Zionism is something that started in the late 1800s. But we see it's very, it's manipulated, right? We're only supposed to react to what's happening now. And we need to understand how things have developed to be the way they are in this current moment. I'm wondering if you could help us. We have some people logged on who are part of our revolutionary summer school, and they're taking on political education in a deeper way. And I don't mean to put you on the spot. I'm not asking for a full bibliography of Palestinian history right now, but I'm wondering if you can orient us on how to take on studying better Zionism, studying the history of Palestine, that can help us better understand the political and colonial situation that's today.
Gosh, yeah, it is. It's hard to know where to start because there is a lot of good material, but I think the key thing is, you know, when you look at anything, when you look at any narrative, you always have to start by asking whose voice is included and whose voice is excluded. And the way the story of Palestine has been told in the United States in particular, it's almost always to the exclusion of Palestinian voices. And so one example is, the New York Times one of its podcasts had a discussion on the one state solution, which is a position I've advocated for many years. My first book, One Country, is about the one state solution. And it's only because, you know, a prominent liberal Zionist voice, Peter Beinart, recently came around to this position that Palestinians have been promoting and discussing for many, many years, that the New York Times had a discussion on it with no Palestinians. And that is just so typical. So I think the first thing is really to be very aware of who is speaking and whose voice is being left out of the discussion. So, yeah, I'm not sure if that answers the question. In terms of a bibliography, maybe that's something I can think about and send to you, and that's something you can share with the participants in the summer school. I'd love to do that. So I'm going to make a note for myself to send you some suggestions.
Thank you so much. I'm sure we will all appreciate it very much. And while we have you, I think I would love to hear a little bit about your two books, what you've proposed in both of your publications, and also about the work of the Electronic Intifada. And we're sharing links of where you can find both of Ali's books as well as the Electronic Intifada website. But I think it would be great to hear what's put forward in these texts and why we should study them.
Thank you. Yeah, well, the Electronic Intifada is, for those who are unfamiliar with it, basically a news publication that we started almost 20 years ago. And I'm very proud of the work we do because we have fantastic writers. Most of our reporting is done by Palestinians living in Palestine. They know their situation better than anyone. And so we have great people writing from Gaza, from other places, but we also have really good analysis. a really good cultural coverage, coverage of how Palestine is talked about in U.S. politics and, in the context of the current political debates in the United States. And so I encourage everyone to just check out Electronic Intifada. We have, for example, I'm just looking at the front page now. One of the stories we have is on the Jewish National Fund, which markets itself in the United States as an environmental charity. This is a perfect example of what I call greenwashing. But in fact, the Jewish National Fund raises charitable tax-deductible funds in the U.S., and uses it to help Israel ethnically cleanse Palestinians from their land. So we try to give people very well-researched knowledge that they can use in campaigns and use to educate people. We have a wonderful video on the front page now about a girls' football team in Gaza. So it's just, we do these short videos of 3 or 4 minutes that sort of give a glimpse of life that is not typically seen on TV screens in the US. And we have some really good articles on some of what we've discussed today. We have a piece on the front page now by Adam Mahoney about the similarities, or the commonalities is a better word, between the Black Lives Matter struggle and the Palestinian struggle. So we try to keep it fresh. We work hard. We publish almost every day. We're publishing something new. And I'm really proud of the work that our team does. I work with some of the best and most dedicated people. So in terms of my books, the first one, which I mentioned, is called One Country, which came out in 2006 or 2007. And at the time, this was not a new idea, of course, a one-state solution, but it was an effort to revive it at a point when all the investment in terms of the media discussion and the political discussion was the two-state solution. And so I tried to imagine what a just and hopeful one-state solution would look like, and also look at the political trends within Israel and more broadly and see where they were going, and also to try to learn lessons from, as I mentioned, South Africa. It's been interesting to see sort of a revived interest now in a one-state solution and sort of people coming back to an idea that, again, has had several lives throughout the Palestinian struggle. It certainly was not my idea, but I tried to bring some new thinking to it. And in the years since then, of course, my thinking has developed. I certainly might approach it in some different ways if I were starting that now. And I certainly tried to bring some new thinking or some further thinking to the battle for justice in Palestine in 2014. But what I really tried to do also in the battle for justice in Palestine is give people tools to understand a lot of the Israeli propaganda strategies and arguments. So, for example, I look closely at pinkwashing and greenwashing, these propaganda strategies Israel talks about. I look at the campaign to silence and smear particularly college students on campuses, Israel's effort to fight back against growing support for Palestinian rights among young people, and what that means in terms of academic freedom and freedom of speech. And those battles have really intensified even in the few years since that book came out. And also to ask a really fundamental question, which is about, because you keep hearing, it's sort of a standard line of Israeli propaganda, Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state. So one of the chapters in that book ask the question, does Israel have a right to exist as a Jewish state? And I try to look at that question very methodically and clearly and provide an answer. You won't be that surprised by the answer, which is, I don't think Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state. But you have to understand how you get to the answer. You have to know the arguments and the facts. And then I also looked at something that I think has gotten very little attention in general, which is the extent to which Palestine or Palestinians were guinea pigs for kind of neoliberal economic experimentation. During the 1990s and the 2000s, you had all these really terrible characters, people like Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister who then became an international envoy, coming in and trying to socially engineer Palestinians in ways to make them sort of docile consumers instead of political beings and collectives who are fighting for liberation. In other words, let's give everyone credit cards and mortgages and then they won't be so worried about politics. And in a sense, that's what they're trying to do to all of us in the world now. You know, people are so burdened with debt. And during this period, we see, you know, the introduction of consumer credit in Palestine. This was all encouraged by the so-called international community, very much with the idea that if Palestinians have credit cards to pay and car loans to pay and housing loans to pay, then they can't afford personally to get involved in politics. So that very much, so the, you know, privatization. So again, and this was done with Iraq as well. After the US invasion of Iraq, you had all these right-wing think tanks in Washington who wanted to use Iraq as this kind of testing ground for these ultra-capitalist, ultra-neoliberal ideas that they hoped would be then they could bring back to the United States. So I also talk about the sort of Palestine as a neoliberal laboratory for really dystopian and destructive policies that that would then, you know, be implemented on all of us, and which have been to a large extent.
You have been listening to Palestinian journalist, author, and activist Ali Abu Nima speaking before the New York Forum. If you are not subscribing to the Electronic Intifada online, I urge you to check it out at electronicintifada.net. All one word, electronicintifada.net. It is free and well worth your attention. Try it out and keep informed. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. So long until next week. من مخيم إلى